monster for us tonight, and really efficient. I think he anchors the defense in a number of ways, being able to switch him out onto smaller guys, distracting and blocking shots. We hope he understands that he can be that kind of player every single night.
I mean, this is the type of player I am as a whole. I mean, this is no surprise to me, to be honest. It's just, you know, I think that we haven't seen this type of play, especially when we're winning, you know. So, me, I'm not really worried about the hype or what people have to really say. It's just me consistently doing this over and over and over, you know, to where it's known and, you know, not second-guessed or doubted. So, it's just me on my end just to keep this consistency in this style of play.
To use DeAndre Ayton's own language, tonight would be the third over. To do this over and over and over, he could complete that tonight with another strong performance. Back-to-back games for the Suns against the Denver Nuggets, who a lot of people still have them near the top of the pecking order in the Western Conference. They've, you know, had an uneven start so far. They're 7-7, but they have the talent. You know, they were a Western Conference Finals participant a year ago. They have the talent to compete. This is another big test, not only for DeAndre Ayton, but for the Suns, who, big picture, as a team, we can get more into the Ayton stuff in a second. They're 8-5 right now. And I don't feel like they've come close to playing as well as they can as a team yet. That is very encouraging to me.
Okay.
Do you agree with that?
Well, I do agree with that. We said that for the Cardinals for many months, and it never happened. But I do.
Oh, no.
No, listen, I do agree with it when it comes to this basketball team. I think they got off to a real fast start, and I think some of us thought it would be happening a little faster than it did. But the DeAndre Ayton element here is driving a lot of the new, renewed optimism because... for a lot of reasons, I've said for a couple weeks now, if the Phoenix Suns can actually get a pick-and-roll component, a dangerous pick-and-roll component rolling, this offense is going to be impossible to stop. And that can happen with DeAndre Ayton's participation. What I've seen the last couple games, perfect shows of aggression, playing loudly, playing with impact, helping his team win. It's going to change everything, and if he keeps it up, it will not only make Suns fans happy and teammates happy, it will change the balance in terms of refereeing and how they treat him. He will get to the free throw line a heck of a lot more. It will change the way other teams look at him. Nobody heretofore has been afraid to bump into or guard DeAndre Ayton in the post. He starts posterizing people, dunking on people. That's going to change. And so I think there's a whole world that might be opening up for DeAndre Ayton here at a very, very fortuitous time for this organization. Can he sustain it? Do you trust him? There's an element here of risk, because I think we all don't know that the answer to that. We really don't. We don't know what DeAndre Ayton really thinks and really feels about what he's accomplished the last couple games. You hear what he says, but it's what he always says. Mm-hmm. It's the same stuff. Do you trust that he can sustain this 9 games out of 10, 8 games out of 10? We all don't know that yet. That's what makes it so interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. But I think we're getting close. It's hard to say. I mean, the last 2 games have been so encouraging. We're getting closer to what is being said by DeAndre Ayton consistently. We're getting closer to that being the reality of what he puts out there night in, night out. And again, you know, with Denver in town and Nikola Jokic is having a fantastic season. He's one of the best centers, if not the best center in the NBA right now. But DeAndre Ayton in his career has played very well against Jokic. He's played very well against Denver in 5 games, 22-13 is what he's averaging. So if he could put that type of production up with the optical elements of it being similar with the aggressiveness, and it's not a lot of fading away from the hoop and to get your 22.
No.
If it's the efficiency with
dunk
which he's been
people.
Playing with a high shooting percentage, that means a lot in this whole mix as well. I'm real curious to see it again because I'm also curious. DeAndre Ayton has been such a frequent topic on this show. And some of our more heated discussions over the past few years have been with him as the central point because he's got that much in terms of expectation on him.
Mm-hmm.
But we've seen the reaction, too, of people now getting excited about DeAndre Ayton. I'm not confident to the point where, okay, he's elite level now, and because he's had two good games, this is going to be the baseline. I think he's still in that group. The upswing is there, but there's going to be a bad game coming. Whenever that comes, I want to see what the reaction is, not just from the public and the guys that are and the people that are critics of DeAndre Ayton, but him as well.
But then it gets down to defining the bad game. The bad game, I wouldn't define it as having a night where he shoots poorly or whatever. If he's just aggressive and intense, I'm fine. My standards are very, very low. And it's not like you're asking for X amount of production every time you play the basketball game. No, just play hard and play with intensity. And it's been markedly different the last two games. His dunk statistics are proof. That's all he has to do. That's all he has to do. And that is why people get sideways with him. It's there. He just has to do it. I think it was really interesting the terms that Devin Booker and Chris Paul chose to use to describe his second really good performance in a row, a performance in which he outshined both of them. They both were like, more. Show us more. Devin Booker, you've got the cut, even came out and said, I don't want his head to get too big. I don't want him thinking, okay, that's good.
It was definitely not a lot of rah-rah.
No.
This is what we expected.
Because you can expect that. That's fair to expect it. It's fair to expect intensity.
Absolutely. Here's Devin Booker earlier in the week after that game in Houston talking about wanting to see more.
I want to see more. I want to see more. And that's what I told him. You know, I mean, there's probably quotes from, you know, early on in his rookie season where, you know, I told him 16-10 is cool. Like, it's cool, but I see 30-20 out of you. I think he's turned that page, like I said. And I don't want to keep, you know, talking him up, but he has to keep playing, and he understands that. And that goes for our whole team. You know, we have to stay locked in. It's a long season. You know, there's going to be highs, there's going to be lows, but, you know, keeping that same mentality and approach, you know, the same each time you go out there is what's consistent.
Yeah, and it's starting to, the back-to-back games that Ayton had, 16 and 17 rebounds, playing with force, playing with that intensity that he's been
five block shots,
a career high. People are taking notice nationally as well from ESPN's The Jump. They asked the question to the panel, was Ayton's big game something, nothing, or everything? Zach Lowe.
It's definitely something because you could see for a team that's off to a good start, Phoenix's starting five, either version, the Jay Crowder version or the Cam Johnson version, just hasn't clicked. And one of the reasons this hasn't clicked is you can see DeAndre Ayton trying to find his way. What's my role? What should I do? How many shots should I take? His usage is down. He's settling for way too many fadeaways from the post. He doesn't get to the foul line. But that DeAndre Ayton, the one that asserts his place in that starting five and rampages to the rim and gets to the line, that guy makes the Phoenix Suns a really interesting team. And look, it's just going to take time. They have a lot of new pieces. Chris Paul changes your identity as a team for the better, but it just takes time. And you can see Chris and Devin Booker trying to feel out how to play off of each other instead of just play your turn, my turn basketball. And DeAndre Ayton's been kind of a victim in that process until last night. So it's definitely something.
And that's another number to gauge that Zach Lowe brought up there is the free throw attempts. You've set the benchmark that you'd like to see on a regular basis at six. He hasn't reached that in the last two games. But, you know, from what it was, you'll take 4 of 5 against Memphis. You'll take 4 of 4 against Houston because he went two games prior to that against Indiana and Washington where he didn't shoot one.
Yeah.
So it's definitely trending in the right direction. Same question, same panel on ESPN's The Jump. Kendrick Perkins, was it something, nothing, or everything?
I can't believe you, Zach. So you just called out all those points and named out all those points, and he had a monster game and dominated, and you just said it's something? It's everything. He's the X factor. Look, We know what we're going to get out of Chris Paul. You know what you're going to get out of Devin Booker. Now we need to know what we're going to get out of DeAndre Ayton. I'm sorry. But he has to come along and play dominant. He has to be a force like he did last night for Phoenix to even have a chance of making any type of noise this postseason. And he's doing just that. It is the CP3 effect. This is the same effect that he had on DeAndre Jordan when he was with the Clippers. CP3 brings out that killer instinct, and that's what DeAndre Ayton needs.
You ready for the random fact of the day?
Yeah.
Because he just brought up DeAndre Jordan.
Okay.
I was on a website that I use for pronunciations for NBA names, and currently there are 4 players in the NBA with the first name DeAndre, and they all spell it with the same exact letter combination, but nobody spells it the exact same way.
Wow. DeAndre is a small A.
Yes.
DeAndre Jordan has a capital A.
Yes.
Now we're getting into the apostrophes.
Yeah, exactly right.
All right, tell me the rest.
DeAndre Hunter.
Okay.
And DeAndre Bembry.
Okay.
That's why, if you go on Twitter...
Interesting. Okay.
Bob Baum, who retired as an AP writer here in Phoenix, he spent a good portion of his last days on the job correcting the spelling on Twitter. People misspelling DeAndre Ayton's name. I don't know. It's one of those quirky things.
Yeah, okay. That's cool.
DeAndre Ayton.
I was able to drown my sorrows. Drown my sorrows.
Sorry, remind me of that.
No, that's great. That's absolutely great.
Look, Kendrick Perkins has been one of the national voices that's been the most bullish on the Suns.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to when the Chris Paul trade was rumored to when it happened, I believe he was the first national voice really to say, hey, this could be a Western Conference Finals participant. Now, you know, this performance from DeAndre Ayton was everything. It won't be everything if he doesn't follow it up.
Mm-hmm.
If he goes back and slips into old ways. And I think we've kind of gone back and forth, not really argued about it, but presented different points on statistical output.
Yeah.
But you make a really good point on that. You can't go back. You know, the bad statistical nights will happen, but you can't go back to the way you were conducting yourself on too regular a basis,
yeah,
where you float. You're not aggressive. You're not intense.
Yes.
I like the way you put that.
Thank you. Because it's true. He was so engaged, and it led to 5 block shots. Do you know what a big number that is in the NBA?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's seriously. But that guy is built to be an all-timer in block shots. He could easily be a Defensive Player of the Year candidate perennially. Easily. And maybe he's looking at that Rudy Gobert money. Maybe the trade rumors, the trade wins, if you will, that maybe started circulating with the Dave Pasch report on this radio station. Maybe that's gotten to him. Maybe he realizes, whoa, wait a minute. Yeah, you're right.
Playtime's over.
Yeah, exactly. Playtime's over.
You pointed this out either yesterday or the day before, but in contrast to Kyler Murray, it's great to see, at least perceptually, how open DeAndre Ayton is to help, criticism, people being on him, listening to advice, all that stuff.
There was times last year when you could see the pushing happening. There was some pushback from DeAndre Ayton last year. You could tell there were times that he just had enough of it. The Chris Paul factor is different.
Mm-hmm.
It's because it's Chris Paul. And, you know, that sort of thing matters in the NBA.
It's true. Remember that
really
press
does.
Conference when they first made the trade? Man, we got Chris Paul, baby. Everybody be happy, start dancing, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So you do it 3 games in a row, you do it 4, you do it 5. You just come to work with a different level of burn, and it's all good. Everything else is going to fall into place.
Yep. Suns and Nuggets tonight, 8 o'clock tip, national television for the 3rd time this week for the Suns. You can hear it here on 98.7 FM, Arizona Sports Station. Pregame starts at 7:30. Last night in the NBA, we had the doubleheader, Lakers beating the Bucks, and then the night game, the Jazz beat the New Orleans Pelicans. The Pelicans have been disappointing so far. 5-9 start they're off to. Jazz have not been disappointing. 11-4. And I guess during the TNT studio portion, Shaquille O'Neal made some sort of comment about Donovan Mitchell. Mm-hmm. He doesn't believe that he can be the number one offensive option on a championship-level team. Independently of that, Donovan Mitchell had his best game of the year last night. 36 points on 11 of 19 shooting, 6 of 8 from three-point range, 7 rebounds, 5 assists, blocked a shot as well. Really good performance from a very good young player. Now, maybe Shaq felt he had to bring this up to Donovan Mitchell in a post-game interview right after the game concluded, but he did, and it got a little weird.
Part of this is Shaq. I said tonight that you are one of my favorite players, but you don't have what it takes to get to the next level. I said it on purpose. I wanted you to hear it. What do you have to say about that?
All right. That's it.
That's it?
That's it.
Okay, cool.
I mean,
I've been hearing
that since my rookie year. You know, I'm just going to get better and do what I do.
Good.
At the end of the day.
Well, that's what I wanted to hear you say. Yes, love your game, brother. Keep it up.
Appreciate it.
Love your game. Keep it up. But I don't think you're good enough to be a first option on a championship.
Very strange. That was very, very odd.
That was the hard-hitting Shaq.
Yeah, I don't know if I like that. There's so much I like about that program. That just seemed, like you said, it got real, real weird. If Donovan Mitchell were a guy that Shaq was trying to mentor and thought, okay, the only way this guy is going to succeed is if I embarrass him or I claim he'll never get there on national television, that might be one thing. But for Donovan Mitchell to take that moment and come back and finally say, Shaq, people have been doubting me my whole life, and then Shaq goes, that's what I needed to hear, that just tells you Shaq just staged that moment for Shaq.
Well,
right?
No? It could have been a lot less. Yeah, I think so. I think you're right. But it could have been a lot less awkward and a heck of a lot more professional if Shaq says, hey, I said tonight on the broadcast, Donovan, I don't think you're a top offensive option on a championship-level team, but you shut me up tonight. Great game. And then follow it up with a question. At least point it back at you a little bit.
Something. Yeah, the delivery. It's like, could you imagine Joe Montana doing an interview and telling that to Josh Allen, like right now? Or like A-Rod telling that to Mike Trout?
Yeah. Yeah, sure, the numbers look great, but yeah, I don't think you're all there, man.
I don't think you can get there. Oh, really, Shaq? And did you max out your career? Oh, wait, sorry. I did not like that. Donovan Mitchell handled it fairly well. You could tell he looked like he was completely ambushed, though. He was like, all right, hey, what?
It was very strange. And it got stranger when you figure... Or you factor in that Kenny Smith had to explain the reasoning behind the question.
Yeah, I think, you know, in spite of what our candid conversation, you guys were one of the top five players. You obviously couldn't see you playing the game. You know, you guys are one of the top five teams in the league. And when the question was like, I asked the panel, I was like, can this guy be one of the top five players in the league? And how can he do it? Because these two guys have done it. And the one thing that we were saying is, being able to affect the game in rebounding and assist as well as scoring, because each year you become a more lethal scorer you have each year. And that second way, then you'll be talked about with these guys, with Shaq and Charles and LeBron's of the world, because you're putting your team in position with your offensive repertoire. So that's the open conversation that you did not hear that went on.
Got you.
Getting you into that next level.
Got you.
Look, Kenny having to do Shaq's spin control for him on live television.
Yeah, it's just odd. I mean, that whole thing is...
He made his first All-Star team last year. Uh-huh. Right now, he's averaging 24.3 points per game. As a rookie, Bick averaged over 20 points a game and has increased that scoring number. And I know Suns Twitter and Jazz Twitter, they have this Devin Booker, Donovan Mitchell warfare going on, mm-hmm. back and forth about who's the better player, and Suns Twitter tends to drag Donovan Mitchell's name through the mud, and he's overrated. He's a really good basketball player. I thought that was really unfair.
Yeah. Suns fans should know better. If you've spent all this time defending Devin Booker against baseless claims of being a stat stuffer and all that, don't go doing that to Donovan Mitchell. Terrific young player.
Yeah, and he's only 24 years old. Yeah. Another weird thing happened last night. Golden State loses to the Knicks, and that's not the weird thing, although the Knicks are actually pretty decent this year under Tom Thibodeau. Good for them. But in the first half of that game, Draymond Green comes down, throws an entry pass to James Wiseman, who's not in position, or maybe the pass was too early, whatever, leads to a turnover. On the way back down the floor, Draymond Green starts yelling at his teammate, quote-unquote, coaching him up. They stop play. Draymond Green already had a technical foul in the game. They call a second technical on him. He gets ejected from the game. They go on to lose. Here was Steve Kerr, the head coach of the Warriors, after the game, explaining the rationale by the officials.
At halftime, Ben Taylor came out and told me that it was a mistake, that he didn't realize that John Butler didn't realize that Draymond was yelling at his teammate. He thought he was yelling at him.
Understand people make mistakes. I'm sure you'd say the same. How did it impact the rest of the game that Draymond couldn't play in the second half?
Well, I mean, obviously, Draymond is, one of our best and most impactful players. So it hurt us, but we were playing very poorly to that point anyway. So I'm not going to talk about the officiating. I'm going to talk about our poor play. We just foul constantly. You can't win. We're dead last in the league in fouls, I think, and free throw attempts allowed.
Pretty classy response. A lot of coaches would have been. It was a 5-point game at that point, Vic, so still reachable. The Knicks, yeah. The Knicks won rather comfortably. The NBA put out a pool report, interview conducted by Monte Poole of NBC Sports Bay Area with the crew chief Ben Taylor last night, who was mentioned by Steve Kerr. Question. Why was Draymond Green assessed a second technical foul with 1:04 remaining in the second quarter? The answer, Green received a second technical foul for profanity that was deemed to be directed at the official. Question. It appeared Warriors coach Steve Kerr and several players were trying to tell you Draymond was addressing teammate James Wiseman. Was that the explanation you heard? Taylor. Yes, it was. Question from the reporter. Did you consider rescinding the second technical foul after hearing their explanation? Answer. No, we did not. Then why did you go apologize at halftime? Why did you say you erred in making that call? It was weird. It was mishandled. And then they doubled down on mishandling it. Not that I want to stick up for Draymond Green at all. Yeah. But that was bogus.
Okay. I understand that. I also, one thing that resonated with me about Steve Kerr's comments were about his team fouling way too much. I've always thought, dude, that as much as I love the NBA and as much as I love the NFL, my two favorite sports to watch, how much more I would love them if they could throw fewer penalty flags in football and call fewer fouls in basketball. And I've thought in basketball, isn't there a better way to keep this game going and stop with the free throw shooting? And then I can never come up with an alternative solution because you give each player 6 fouls, and that seems about the right number in terms of, how many fouls you can have. But you know what I mean? I'm saying that those are the two sports more than any where official stoppages via flags and fouls really hold the game back.
Yeah, I can't speak to it because I didn't watch the game.
Yeah.
But we've all watched games where it seems like it's a foul fest and maybe it's being over-officiated.
Yep.
That game last night, it might, and Steve Kerr kind of made reference to it, we fouled constantly.
Mm-hmm.
They actually had less fouls than the Knicks, but that game had 80 free throw attempts in it.
Yep. That's crazy.
That's not fun.
No, it's not fun. And that's the kind of thing that it can ruin it for me. If I get caught up into a basketball game that turns into a free throw shooting contest and I don't have a vested interest, I'm out of there.
Mm-hmm.
So,
coming up next, we'll get into some NFL hash marks. We go around the league straight ahead. It's Bickley and Murata on this Friday, live from the Ak Chin Community Studios, 98.7 FM, Arizona Sports Station.
Bickley and Murata, hash marks.
This team is going to take on the identity of this city, all right? And the city's been down, and it found a way to get up, all right? It's found a way to overcome adversity, all right? And so this team's going to be built on, we're going to kick you in the teeth, all right? And when you punch us back, we're going to smile at you. And when you knock us down, we're going to get up. And on the way up, we're going to bite a kneecap off, all right? And we're going to stand up. And then it's going to take 2 more shots to knock us down, all right? And on the way up, we're going to take your other kneecap, and we're going to get up, and then it's going to take three shots to get us down. And when we do, we're going to take another hunk out of you. Before long, we're going to be the last one standing. All right? That's going to be the mentality.
Lighten up, Francis.
That's one of the early contenders for soundbite of the year.
Yeah, it's
Dan
great.
Campbell
Love
at his
it.
Introductory press conference of the Detroit Lions. We brought that up yesterday, and it started making circulation and getting attention, obviously, right after he said it. The whole kneecap thing got a reaction. And when we talked about it, Jarrett was, I think, better suited to gauge how divisive that those comments and that press conference was. And after the show, I went through and read some articles, and it was some Twitter fights with media people and fans going on. Some people absolutely loved it. Some people hated it. There was a columnist that talks about how Dan Campbell is he's got the advantage of being a meathead, and other coaches that are seeking head coaching positions like Eric Bieniemy couldn't get away with the same thing. It actually turned into a really fascinating study yesterday.
Wow.
But at this point, it is what it is. You might find it goofy. You might find it inspirational. He may have gone too far.
He doesn't expect his players to bite kneecaps. I mean, we know that.
No, but the language was weird.
Yeah.
And I don't really mind it all that much. That's who Dan Campbell was. And I was reading an article today, too, that said when Dan Campbell kind of contacted the Detroit Lions brass and he put forth his written plan and mentality and philosophy as a potential head coach in the NFL, there were people in the Lions front office going, he read our mind.
Yeah.
Like, this is
what we're looking for.
At least at the first step of this relationship, we're hitting it off.
Even if it's all garbage, it's connecting with the audience. It's making Michiganians, it's making them...
Detroitians, right?
Detroitians.
Is that the word? I don't even know. You used Valionians the other day in your blast.
Wichitonians, Kentuckynonians, yeah. We're gonna have some fun with that.
Just Phoenicians.
Right. I don't know. So to me, this is incredibly smart marketing. If you know Detroit, they eat that stuff up. That's who Detroit is. You know?
Until they just get full and then they stop eating it up.
It's a Rust Belt city. They're automakers and steel workers. It's a tough place. And that's the kind of stuff they want to hear, because they have been a beaten down franchise.
Sarah's looked it up. Detroiters is actually correct.
Detroiters? Yeah. Well, I know Michiganders is correct.
Yes.
Okay.
Detroiter.
You can be a Detroiter and a Michigander.
Yes, you can.
Detroita. You want to be French about it.
What was that one?
Detroit.
Detroita. Detroita.
Detroita.
Sorry.
No, don't be sorry.
I'm done.
No, don't be done.
Normally it's one of us that goes off the rail.
Yeah, no, I like that.
Gazelle's chiming in. I love it.
Friday for her, too.
Yeah.
Let's go.
So to me, I think this is something that is really, as somebody who spent a lot of time in that state, I was stunned to hear somebody tell me once, look, you know, for the Red Wings, we love the Red Wings, and the Pistons have won titles, and the Fab Five were phenomenal, and the
Tigers
Wolverines
had success.
Great, and they will tell you, people will tell you that the Lions are the number one franchise, and you're like, what? It just doesn't make any sense, but it's true.
Yeah, the one that hasn't had any sustained success.
Yeah, and it's just been nothing but Daffy, William Clay Ford, Wayne Fonts,
Gary Danielson, Eric Hipple, Billy Sims,
Lomas Brown. So to me this is great. So now if you're a Lions fan, you're jacked up. I don't care if he sounds caveman-esque. We're talking about football, for goodness sakes. What do you want him to do? Get up and talk and quote Nietzsche or Shakespeare? You know what I mean? I mean, come on.
Well, like I said, they had a nerdo as their coach just before that. I mean, he looked like a big, gruff mountain man, but he was
like this.
He's a rocket scientist.
He was a literal rocket scientist.
He was a rocket surgeon.
He was.
With a pencil in his ear. And so, yeah, this is a big...
What a dork!
What a dork.
Dan Campbell was not the only new coach introduced yesterday. Robert Saleh also got his turn on the dais at the podium as the new head coach of the New York Jets and kind of said similar things to Dan Campbell.
We understand that with regards to the what's happened in the past. You know, what we do challenge everybody is to really judge us on moving forward. You know, when you look at the plan and what we have in place with regards to scheme, offense, defense, special teams, and the mindset at which we're going to do it, there's an investment that's going to be made to one another. Coaches to players, players to coaches, organization to everybody. And there's an investment that's going to be reciprocated. But understanding that the all gas, no break mentality that we're going to have with how we wake up in the morning, how we rehab, how we prepare for meetings, how we take the practice field, how we're deliberate in everything we do will lead to the results that you'll see on Sunday. It will take time, but everything we do is going to be designed to win championships in the future.
So obviously a lot of, similar tones, language, obviously different. Robert Saleh was maybe the, outside of Urban Meyer coming from retirement / college football, Robert Saleh might have been the most sought after guy this offseason. And we asked this question about Eric Bieniemy, and now there's one job opening left. It's Houston. They have interviewed Eric Bieniemy at least, remotely. And we'll see if they're just waiting for him to be done with his participation with the Chiefs before they offer that job. But you hit on something yesterday. We both did, actually. You know, Eric Bieniemy, at this point, you're down to one job. He's a candidate. He's been a candidate in cycles leading up to this and has been disappointed. And a lot of people have been disappointed that he's not a head coach. But do you want to go to a situation that's seemingly so dysfunctional from the outside as the Houston Texans? Will there be an opportunity down the road? Probably so. The same could be said for Robert Saleh, don't you think? He could have written his ticket. The Jets are a mess. I guess, I mean, it's weighing, okay, nobody succeeded there, can I be the guy? But then the competitive side of coaching comes through. Hey, yeah, listen, I'm going to be the guy to turn this around. So I kind of get that mentality.
And maybe that's if you don't think it's a lost cause, and if you go there and you talk to the owner and you talk to the general manager and you go, okay, these guys aren't idiots. They've just had a very bad product for many years. Maybe you embrace the fact that the bar is really low because, you know, how good do you have to be a success with the New York Jets? So maybe that's appealing to people. I do agree with that with Robert Saleh. I think that in terms of in-house candidates, I don't think he was the biggest prize. I think Urban Meyer is the biggest prize. But I think in terms of the biggest in-house NFL guys, he was the guy that could write his ticket. Because he checks a lot of different boxes.
Yeah, I'm curious to see how these different situations go. And I am curious to see who lands in Houston. Now, the one other one, I don't know if it's become official yet, with Nick Sirianni in Philadelphia, the Indianapolis Colts offensive coordinator being, the guy there. Here's Dan Orlovsky and here's Adam Schefter from ESPN talking about why the Eagles are tabbing Sirianni as their next guy.
The Eagles have been in Florida here conducting interviews for the better part of the last week since they fired Doug Peterson, brought in any number of candidates and went through them. And I think because they started a little bit late firing Doug Peterson a week after some of the other coaches got fired, they were a little bit late to the process. And again, that meant that other coaches landed other jobs elsewhere before the Eagles could have all the options that they wanted. Still had plenty of options of plenty of good candidates out there. And ultimately, in the end, I think that they felt most comfortable with Nick Sirianni, who's worked under Frank Reich in Indianapolis and knows the Philadelphia system.
Yeah, and there's a lot of people saying that this is ownership investing even deeper into Carson Wentz, which now you ask the question about Jalen Hurts' future. If Carson Wentz is going to get an opportunity to rekindle what he had in Philadelphia at that price tag, and he's able to do it, Jalen Hurts is not going to be long for the Eagles.
No.
I wouldn't have said that a month ago.
No. And I really, and I've said this before, but I really like what I've seen from Jalen Hurts. There's a lot of stuff to work with there. from poise to dual threat stuff. So if the Philadelphia Eagles trade him, or if I were a team that thought he was obtainable and I needed a quarterback, I'd be all over that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He'd be at the top of my list, too. It's Bickley and Murata coming to you live from the Ak Chin Community Studios here on 98.7 FM, Arizona Sports Station.
98.7 FM, Arizona's sports station. Bickley and Murata.
Bickley and Murata.
I played with some ball players that knew how to play the game. And they taught me an awful lot. And I took it upon myself to learn all that I could from them.
That is the voice of Hank Aaron, who passed away today at the age of 86. He was talking over the summer, last summer, with ABC News, celebrating the 100-year anniversary of the Negro Leagues. That's where he started, with the Indianapolis Clowns as a 19-year-old. I just looked it up, Bick. Do you remember the story? It happened a couple months ago.
All right.
Major League Baseball ruled that the Negro Leagues and all attached statistics would be considered major league statistics.
Assimilated, yeah. Integrated.
So I don't know what that process entails. I don't know how complete the records are from the beginning of that era. But I just looked it up, and it's only Wikipedia, so who knows how accurate it is. But on Hank Aaron's Wikipedia page, the House Sports Bureau credits Aaron with a .366 batting average in 26 official Negro League games with 5 home runs, 33 runs batted in, 41 hits, and 9 stolen bases. That would, if 5 is indeed the number,
that would put him at .760.
.760, 2 behind Barry Bonds. Again, I don't know.
Can you find 2 more home runs in there somewhere?
Too bad they didn't.
3, actually.
Yeah, can you find 3 more?
Could they have found that a couple years ago? Maybe get him a few more at-bats?
Yeah. Seriously.
Just to your point earlier is that, you know, you use the term stolen, and a lot of people who love baseball feel that that was the case with Hank Aaron's home run record.
Yeah, so I think that's all in this emotional soup. This is a really heavy-hearted day in Major League Baseball. Hank Aaron, like I said, age 86. So in terms of the natural order of things, he lived a long, full life.
Uh-huh.
But I think it's a couple of things. I think we all realize that man, it was a lot harder for that man than it needed to be. And that's not on him. And then for his trouble and for his anguish and for his resilience, he gets lapped by Barry Bonds. So I think there's some guilt that goes along with it. And also, you know what? Henry Aaron, he's one of the iconic figures from the golden era of baseball.
One of the last ambassadors of a bygone era of the sport.
Like that. That's well said. And so I think anything Major League Baseball can do to honor, to focus, to bring that back to light. I said the other day, I think this is a great time to finally let Pete Rose in the Hall of Fame, to lift the ban against Pete Rose. He's paid enough. He's paid enough.
And then the other question is, who would really be upset if they did that?
Not me.
With Pete Rose?
Yeah.
Jared, I mean, I don't want to go down this road with you, but there's people that are upset about everything.
Yes, of course.
So to answer your question, a good number of people would take offense to it.
Somebody will be. But I mean, it's like, and I get this. I mean, there's stuff going on with Curt Schilling right now. You and I talked before the show. Curt Schilling might be on his way to the Hall of Fame, and yet there was a column written by my buddy Ken Summers. Do the Diamondbacks or the Red Sox even want their cap on that man's head in the Hall of Fame, given his political leanings and some of the things he said? And maybe considered toxic by some?
I haven't been able to vet it very much, but I read an article today with a tweet from a pretty connected guy. It reported that there's several Hall of Fame voters who did finally include Curt Schilling on their ballot, but because of recent events not having to do with baseball, are seeking to get their ballots back.
That's staggering to me. That's unbelievable to me.
Can you do that?
I don't know.
I don't think there's any precedent for it, quite honestly.
I don't know either.
Going back to Hank Aaron, too, you mentioned everything that he had to endure during his career. And you know, we've got the TVs on in the studio, mm-hmm. and there was one. And there's that famous shot. It's a photocopy of the death threat he got from a fan in the South when he was approaching that home run record. Howard Bryant is an ESPN columnist, longtime writer. He was on First Take this morning, kind of reflected on the career and life of Hank Aaron. And listen to what Howard Bryant said.
He used to talk about not wanting to feel like the country was going backwards. And it was amazing that whenever we talked about things, we talked about where the country was going as much as sports and everything else. And I was always fascinated by his ability to talk about these things.
And went on to say, after all these years, wasn't bitter after all that he went through. So appreciated what he had, even though it was not anything resembling an easy road to get where he ended up.
There was, because of what he went through, I said this earlier, I'm going to repeat it again. There are people out there who believe that maybe Hank Aaron died with a special kind of peace, given his political leanings, given what he's been through, and given the fact that he was just completely, utterly demoralized by the events that, from George Floyd to everything that followed, that after he had lived his entire life of struggle, he kind of felt the country was in a better place. And seeing that not a ton had changed, at least in some areas, had really made him despondent. I read that and I was very, very sad. There are people who are saying that he might have been hanging on to see that kind of victory. I don't know. I didn't know him that well. I've been efforting to refine those stories and I can't. I will just say this, great ambassador to baseball, an iconic figure in sports, a picture of consistency, royalty, regal, all-time home run leader in my book.
I was trying to think, who are the equivalents in the other major sports? Is Jim Brown?
It's a good one.
The one in football?
Definitely.
That's a good one.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in basketball?
I think Bill Russell in basketball.
Bill Russell
probably dealt with a lot of the same garbage that Hank Aaron had to deal with.
That's a good one.
Especially playing in a city like Boston.
Man. Yeah, it's...
Plus, like, the bygone era ambassador kind of thing.
Well, and I brought that up, too. You know, Hank Aaron was an Atlanta Brave, you know, in the Deep South in the 70s, and was in the Deep South in the 60s when the Braves moved there. That was another point that Howard Bryant made on First Take today, was, you know, being in Milwaukee, he didn't want to go to Atlanta.
He didn't want to go to Atlanta because of how, you know, he didn't want to go back to the Deep South. And then he sat down with Ralph Abernathy and Dr. King and Andrew Young, and they told him, you're as important to this movement and to black people as we are. And we need you. We need you to come here. And that conversation, all talking about that, he sort of sat back and he said, ask whatever question you need. It was almost as if his memory reminded him of, I have a part in this American story.
He's one of those players, too, Bick, that, you know, as somebody who loves the history of baseball and, you know, wanted to be able to appreciate the great players, I do have very early memories of watching Hank Aaron, but as a designated hitter with the Milwaukee Brewers when I was like 5 or 6 years old.
when Bernie the Brewer would fall down to the big mug of beer after home runs. Benny the Brewer, whatever he was called.
I never got to see him at his best.
Yeah.
He's near the top of the list of guys that I would have wanted to watch play.
Yeah. He's also from that era that I did, where the baseball uniforms were just the bomb to me. The kind of the material was kind of like that light gray flannelish kind of thing. I loved the style of Major League Baseball era.
Are you going back to like late 50s and 60s when he was in Milwaukee? Those or the funky
70s
or the funky pullover jersey that he broke Babe Ruth's record in?
Not that one.
Okay.
No.
Because I actually love that uniform too.
Not that one at all.
What I think about every time I see that home run is how crappy the stadiums were for a stretch in the 70s, and then it went up through like the 80s.
Yeah. When the Pirates played at Three Rivers, when you had those multi-purpose bowls that served for football and baseball,
the cookie
cutters. Yeah.
And then the AstroTurf that was just like a carpet on top of cement, essentially.
Yeah, right.
And a lot of them had like these big walls, so you couldn't even see the fans in the... Terrible.
Can you imagine what the injuries would be like today if they still played on AstroTurf?
With the speed of the game today?
Or the reaction of the players?
Oh, man. Seriously.
Man, those guys had it rough.
Oh, yeah.
Coming up next, we're halfway through on this Friday. The Bickley Blast is straight ahead. It's Bickley and Murata, 98.7 FM, Arizona Sports Station.